I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the Lazy CEO podcast. I'm Jay Liu. Join my conversations with the entrepreneurs behind the iconic brands we all know and love.
Hey, Potty fam. Welcome back to part two of my chat with Roslyn Kogan. Quick TLDR, Roslyn is the founder and CEO of Kogan, one of Australia's largest online retailers, known mostly for their electronics and white goods, and makes over $1 billion in sales annually. In this episode, we talk about how to use PR to get attention and how his fight with Jerry Harvey was a clever tactic that grew the business, how he became overstocked post-COVID and how he overcame it, and growing additional income streams using the subscription model. All right, let's get into it. So were you always techie? Because you already had a website design business by 1997 and at this point, I think 2 years later, I actually got my first email address. So like that was so ahead of the times.
Always loved tech, always loved gadgets. So from a very young age, I remember going to computer swap meets and wanting a computer and then building my first computer. I was around the age, I think my parents got it for me, either my 9th birthday or 10th birthday, which I put together using parts from the swap meet and knew that it'll be using this Matsushita, which is the Japanese name for Panasonic CD-ROM drive, or this much RAM or memory, this motherboard, and put it all together because you could save a little bit of money putting a computer together if you bought the parts at a swap meet. So always into that. Prior to a website design business in high school, I also ran a mobile phone repair business because lots of people at the time, phones were really expensive. Lots of people had phones, but phones broke a lot. But the way you fix them was usually pretty simple.
Because it's not like back then you could just Google how to do it either.
Yeah, but asking people, hanging around a few mobile phone repair shops, seeing how they do it and all of that. Most problems in a mobile phone could be fixed with a toothbrush and methylated spirits.
You're just turning off and on.
You're literally similar to turning it off and on. You open up the phone, clean the main chipset or main board a little bit, close it back up, boom, it'll probably start working. So most things, like with computers, you switch it off and on, it starts working. Fixing mobile phones wasn't that hard.
Right.
Doing a bit of that. Then website design business where actually our CTO now, Goran Stefkovski, one of my closest friends through high school, we started a website design business together. We're both very into tech.
Wow. And you've been working together throughout. That's amazing.
He did a law engineering degree. Then he worked at a law firm. And then Kogan started going gangbusters. And he'd been helping me out a lot on the side while being one of the top lawyers in the country. And then I was like, no, mate, please leave that. Let's do this together. Ran that website design business, which was funny because a lot of it we tried to do without seeing people. This is back when no business had a website. Like we'll go into bakeries and saying, hey, you should have a website. So if someone searches you, your bakery comes up and just say what your opening hours are and have a few photos of the breads that you make. So like think of it as a really cheap Yellow Pages listing because every business was in the Yellow Pages, but nobody had websites or domain names or any of that.
Wait, let me ask my assistant, Gen Z assistant in the room, Caitlin, do you know what the Yellow Pages are? Caitlin's 25.
Yes, I do.
Oh, okay, good.
There was Yellow Pages and White Pages.
Oh, very good. Okay.
I'm young, but I'm not.
Well, I don't know. I'm just checking.
Sorry,
so, yeah, you know, and it's like, you know, everyone does SEO now, but the SEO in Yellow Pages mm-hmm. was like, I will call myself A Bakery. Yeah. That was the form of SEO in the yellow, so that when someone looks up bakery, I'll be the top listing.
Yeah.
So we're convincing businesses to do that. But the funny thing was, we had much more success when we would do it over the phone than when we do it in person, because we were in year 9 at the time.
Oh, okay.
And it's like, here's a couple of, 15-year-old kids rocking up in their dad's suits, trying to sell us a website and convince us that the internet's real. We did all of that. Then obviously I had a few more businesses through college and went to Miami to study as well, and worked in as a network technician and administrator there, and learned a few things. But also in Miami, I saw the rise of online retail. That was, you know, America's quite a few years ahead of Australia. So while I was studying in college there, really saw this industry forming and booming.
What was Australia like and what was the US like back then?
So in Australia, there was eBay, and everyone sort of knew if they wanted to buy a secondhand something, they could probably find it on eBay, but it wasn't mainstream. When I got to the US and settled into our dorm rooms, and it was a whole bunch of international students, and there was a whole bunch of locals in the dorm rooms. And American college is very different to here. Everyone here sort of goes to university close to their home. In America, everyone moves away from their city, flies to another city, lives in dorm rooms on campus. You need to fit out your dorm room of the stuff that you need. And obviously, one of the most essential things you need is a mini bar fridge to store your alcohol.
Yeah.
That's core to a success in college in the US. So one of the first days after arriving there, got together with a whole bunch of international students, and we went to the closest Walmart, which was a schlep away. We had to catch a bus, then a train, got to a Walmart, because at university we had studied how Walmart has economies of scale, really efficient supply chains, price leadership. No retailer can do something better than cheaper than Walmart. We bought our mini bar fridges, schlepped them home on the train and the bus, set them up, and it was a big full day's work, and we had a hard-earned thirst at the end of it and somewhere to keep our beer
cold. That's good.
Next day, we see all the American kids, and they've just got FedEx drivers wheeling bar fridges up to their dorm rooms. Then we talked to the American kids and found out that not only did they spend the whole prior day by the pool and then have the mini bar fridge delivered to their room, they paid half the price that we did. So it made me realize that a small online retailer can operate with greater efficiency than a Goliath like Walmart. Then over time there in Miami, just saw the rise and rise. Everyone was buying stuff online, whether they wanted sunglasses or clothing or new sneakers or whatever, you want, new phone, new computer, new laptop, it's just online, online, online. And that had not happened in Australia yet. So when I got back to Australia and it had not been happening here still, so that's 6 months later, I knew that that trend is going to happen because America was leading the way in that regard. So then when at Accenture that all that stuff happened with not really liking my job and then searching for a TV, not being able to find one, seeing that I could import them cheaper, it was all like connecting the dots and going, bingo.
That's incredible. How did then Kogan scale? What were the biggest milestones in growth that you saw?
A quick summary of it would be, we launched with these two private label products, two TVs, market-shattering prices. It was a 32-inch TV and 40-inch TV. Very popular, sell out the first container, sell out the second container, third container. Then I go, oh, well, we've got a 32 and a 40-inch, then we need a 46-inch and a 55-inch, and, so started to expand the range of TVs. Then technology kept evolving. This is back at a time when TVs had no tuner in them, so you needed a TV and a set-top box, and then started to do set-top boxes and then high-definition set-top boxes. And then technology had evolved where you could have a high-definition tuner in the TV. So started doing TVs with a high-definition tuner built in. then TVs with recording capability, then Blu-ray players, then started to expand out the product range to digital photo frames, GPS units, and it grew and grew and grew as a consumer electronics range. Then we realized, well, what we've built here is a consumer electronics brand that people love. They can save money on lots of products, but it doesn't only apply to consumer electronics. This same supply chain methodology of factory direct to the customer can apply across nearly every category. So we started to expand our categories, and we started to do luggage and homewares and furniture and Manchester and kitchenware and appliances and white goods and so on. So started to really expand out the range, and that was going really well and customers were loving it. We opened ourselves up to other brands. So started working with third-party brands, whether it be a Sony or a Nintendo or a Samsung, and having that on our site because, hey, there's people who love a bargain and who love our really good value stuff, but there's people who also say, nah, I want AirPods. I don't care that I can get the Kogan equivalent ones for $39. I want the AirPods for $399. Mm. And that's fine. We'll beat the market on price, and our supply chain can enable us to sell those cheaper as well. And that was going really well. And after like 10 years, we had IPO'd. So the business was completely organically funded for the first 10 years. After 10 years, we IPO and our growth accelerates because we raised money in the IPO as well. So everything's going great. We had just before that as well launched Kogan Mobile, where we said, look, we've got this huge customer base that loves us. We've got this huge brand. We're selling all of these products really well. There's other industries that are adjacent to ours where we can create value for a customer. Because take someone like Vodafone, for instance. They spend lots of money building out a mobile phone network, building towers all over the country, and then they need customers in order to pay off that asset. Now, they've got their own Vodafone brand and stores and so on, but someone like Kogan can come along with a huge customer base, and we can say to Vodafone, hey, you spend a lot of money on marketing to win new customers. We've got huge customer base who love a bargain. We don't have to spend that money on marketing. Whatever we would have spent on marketing, let's just make the price cheaper and reinvest it in the price point and launch Kogan Mobile at the best prices in the country. And now you have Kogan Mobile where for $100 a year, you can get lots of data, unlimited calls, unlimited text, you know, incredible value. And it's got hundreds of thousands of customers using it. And then we used that model and expanded it to Kogan credit cards, Kogan internet, Kogan insurance, and so on.
Wow.
So we've got all those verticals.
Yeah.
And then we said, well, we've got all these other services. They're going great. We've got all these products. They're going great. But a lot of these retailers around the country contact us and say, hey, can we sell through your platform? So we opened up a marketplace to them as well, which has grown so quickly that it's now the majority of our sales. So we've got thousands of retailers around the country selling their products through the Kogan platform, competing against one another, driving prices down, creating value for our customers.
That is incredible. So how many SKUs are you currently selling through?
50 million. Yeah.
So there's you've got 5,000. I'm like, that's just a lot to manage. Wow.
5,000 is a lot. If you look at our private label range, it's around that.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, our marketplace is
incredible. Yeah.
If you looked at the history of how many unique products are listed on Kogan, it sort of looks like this, like this, like this. When we launched the marketplace.
And so how do you keep quality assurance on, you know, in terms of like dispatching on time and customer service?
For the marketplace especially, it's a very important challenge because it is a risk to the business because you've got in our 18-year history for 14 of those years, we completely control everything. Mm. We control the logistics when an item gets dispatched, tracking details, all of that. Mm. It's important from that regard that when you then let others sell through your platform that they're providing an equal service because you don't want to provide a service to a customer where when they're buying a Kogan branded product, it's brilliant, but the moment they're buying a different product, you never know what you're going to get. So,
and also I think sometimes customers don't really realize and they'll just group it all together.
With the,
and
it's very important. So We have a whole division focused on the seller health scores. So monitoring every seller and seeing from the moment an item gets purchased to the time that the item gets a tracking number, to the time the item actually gets delivered, to the what star rating does a customer give that item once they have delivered it, what a customer says about the item, how many contact queries there are about that item and so on, and monitoring all of these stats and setting a very high bar for them. And the moment any seller doesn't meet our high bar of requirements, we contact them, we coach them, and if they don't immediately rectify whatever the issue is, boom, gone.
Yeah.
These days, they need you more than you need them. So these days we're at such scale where we're always bringing on new sellers, mm-hmm. but every day there's sellers that we're inviting to not participate on our platform anymore.
Because you've always had a really big focus on the customer and putting the customer in the center. I've heard a story about how you used to get onto planes and listen to customer phone calls. I mean, that would frustrate me. It's a very incredible discipline to do that.
I used to have time to actually sit in the call center and take calls.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say Ruslan, I'd say Russell. So it's like, thank you for calling Kogan. This is Russell. How can I help you? And hear the customer, because in online retail, we have a lot of advantages, but we also have a lot of disadvantages. Like when you run a store, you can walk out onto the shop floor and see what's the feel, what's the vibe. Are my customers smiling?
Yeah.
Is there a lot of customers complaining? Are there any, like, what is going on? You can get a really good feel for it. I know Walt Disney used to dress up as Mickey Mouse, and walk around Disneyland because he wanted that raw feedback of what are my customers thinking? What are the children saying? Are they smiling? Mm-hmm. Are they happy? And all of that. So I wanted that for our customers. So I'd be in the call center sometimes and you don't have time. And when planes didn't have Wi-Fi, I would do that. I would download all these calls, jump onto the calls and have a listen and for hours and hours. Now that there's Wi-Fi on planes, I do that less. And I get reports from my team. But yeah, now because there's Wi-Fi on planes, you're like, oh, emails.
We have integrated into our Slack channel. We have a customer love so we can see what's great so we can double down and do more of it. And then also like customer complaints so that it pops into Slack and then you can get a good feel of it.
That's really good because one of my problems is it's feedback I get from our team that I don't celebrate the wins enough that I get a lot of customer emails or I see a lot of stuff where customers are like, oh, love Kogan. Thank you so much. I couldn't afford this. Now I could afford it. Or thanks to you guys, I've decked out my whole apartment with much better stuff and things like that. And I sort of like ignore that. I'm like, great. The happy customers, that's what we're meant to be doing. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of irrelevant information to me because there's nothing we can improve there. And I focus on the small number of complaints that we get. And I'm telling our team like, the happy stuff's good, but like that's just us doing our job.
Yeah.
There's nothing to fix there. Oh, we've got a really happy customer. Great. But the customer who says, hey, this should be different or wasn't quite happy with this or what's happening here, that's the stuff that we need to fix. So we probably need to celebrate the wins a bit more, but I'm not good at that.
So what is it like being the CEO of a listed company? As a CEO, you have to watch your sales numbers and then to have share prices to look at. Obviously, it's a lot of pressure, but what is that like?
As a public company CEO, I guess one of the biggest jobs you have is ensuring your team completely ignores the share price because that is short-term noise. While you're executing a long-term plan. So I remember just after we listed, it was during a difficult time for the economy and straight after listing, our share price tanked, like on the day of listing. I remember I was giving the speech at the ASX and on listing day, like ringing the bell at midday, boom, Kogan's live. And I can see the room full of staff and all of that, and they're sort of watching the share price that's behind me. I can't see it, but I can see from them that it's not looking good. Yeah, I can see from those reactions while trying to deliver the speech. And it is what it is. And we're executing our plan. We're hitting all our metrics. We're hitting all our targets. We're hitting all our goals. We're smashing through customer numbers, revenue goal, all of that. We're doing all of that, but the share price stays down. And our team's a bit confused because they're like, oh, we thought, you know, we'd get listed and we'd have this live tracker of how well we're doing. And you have to explain, no, don't worry. The market in the short term is a voting machine. In the long term, it's a weighing machine, as Warren Buffett would say. And then, you know, yes, it eventually happens. Eventually, you know, you deliver a few quarters and then it went absolutely nuts and the team's happy and realizes. So you've got to sort of explain to them that we do what we do irrespective of the market. Like even the other day, we recently had an announcement of some results and there was a very favorable reaction to it and the share price goes up. But it's like, that's not due to something we did on that day. It goes up based on something we did a year ago.
Yeah. And then the market expectation, which you can't actually control.
So all of that takes a while. So a lot of it is explaining to the team that the share price is irrelevant. We just have to keep executing our strategy. In terms of what the IPO did for us was it was the first time we raised money in the business. 10 years in, it enabled us to accelerate a lot of growth and it accelerated far more than we could have expected. So, you know, then we had the age-old, it's always good to reevaluate your decision-making, but regret is never a good thing. But it gets you thinking like, oh, should we have raised money earlier? Maybe we shouldn't have grown organically for the first 10 years and all that, because seeing what that raising did, it was brilliant for our business. And our team loves the public scrutiny and all of that. But yeah, as a leader, you've got to tell your team, don't watch this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Share price.
Yeah.
Hey, Polly fam, I've got something special for you. For a limited time only, I have a discount code for my business course. In case you didn't know, the course is a blueprint for starting an online business and growing it to 7 or 8 figures. It's 10 modules of videos that you can watch at your own pace, covering everything from sourcing product, growing and developing your product range, operations, and marketing and scaling your business. Just use the code PODCAST at checkout at thelazyceo.com.
So how was COVID for you? We overstocked during COVID, whereas you overstocked after COVID. How did you trade out of that situation?
COVID was interesting for us because at the start of COVID, we played it better than anyone else. Like, you know, running a low-cost business is in our DNA, running a really tight operation, sourcing products that are hard to source, we're great at. So when borders started shutting down, supply chain started shutting down, everyone started to struggle, stores started shutting down. We knew people are working from home. There's a monitor shortage, computer shortage, this shortage. We were able to buy stock from all over the world, from various distributors, and outplay every retailer who had more antiquated supply chains. We had the most profitable half out of any e-commerce company in Australia. We've made over $50 million in a six-month period. We outplayed everyone. Everything's gone great. And then we're like, well, we did all of this with one hand tied behind our back because a lot of stuff, like we did really well, but we could have done even better had we had more inventory in stock. So we stocked up and we built our inventory from $50 million to $250 million. So literally 5x'd our inventory. Overnight, a vaccine came out, lockdown started to end, people were out and about, people were, what was it, revenge shopping or whatever they were calling it at the time. But like they hadn't been to stores for so long. They're like, I don't want to buy online anymore. I just want to buy something from a store. And online sales started to dip for the first time. And here we are taking our inventory from 50 mil to 250, and then sales start to dip. So we had to quickly scale. We scaled from 12 warehouses to 30 warehouses in the space of a few months. Even then, we couldn't fit all the stock in the warehouses. So we had containers sitting in the shipping yards. We were paying penalties on that. Wow. It was like all of that. Then we had to do really heavy discounting, selling below cost. So we made the wrong call. Mm. When we look back at it, we'd probably make the same call again, because we were there for our customers when they needed us most. So if through that entire COVID period, when you're spending all your time at home and cooking for your family, cleaning for your family, doing stuff, working from home, laptops, office chairs, stand-up desks, whatever, we were the main provider. There was shops were closed. If you wanted it quickly, if you wanted it for a good price, we were the main one there. If you wanted masks, if you wanted any of that that people needed. So we made the right decision at the right time with the information available to us, but it ended up being the wrong decision.
Yeah. So I mean, that does sometimes just happen. We decided the year before COVID that we were going to stop selling activewear and sweats and focus on party. So you just, and the product life cycle for us is quite long. So that came into effect in 2020. So it just, it happens to the best of us.
I guess as a business operator, we make thousands of decisions a day. And the important thing is just to
bounce back.
Yeah. You get, aim to get most of them right. Mm-hmm. Aim to get most important ones right. And for the ones you get wrong, go, what could have I done better? Mm-hmm. How could I make a better decision? And so on. So if you do that, you're going to be better today than you were yesterday.
Absolutely.
As long as you can do that, your business in 10 years' time will be absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah.
If you can be better today than you were yesterday, that's all you've got to do. Decision making is a key part of that, and quickly acknowledging when you made the wrong decision, seeing how you could, in the next time those circumstances arise, make the right decision. So for us, what we learned from that is we made the wrong decision at the end of COVID after our super profitable half to build our inventory. We made the wrong decision, but had we had the same information again for the same business structure, we'd probably make that same decision again. We can't fault our decision making there. But we can fault our business model. So then what we decided after that is the wider macroeconomic environment is going to do lots of things over time. And if you try and predict what the economy is going to do, you're going to get it wrong 50% of the time. So build a business that's going to do brilliant no matter what the economy does. And that's the transition and the journey we went on since then. And, you know, we're pretty proud of where we sit now.
And so what are some of the challenges that you're facing today?
There's challenges that pop up over time, all the time. I guess one of the challenges we were facing is that we saw how dangerous too much inventory can be, because it's actual physical stuff that you need in a physical warehouse. And it's like you get that decision right at the right time, brilliant for business. You get that decision wrong at the wrong time, it could almost put you out of business. Yeah. So the challenge we've had is saying, well, how do we ensure that we keep delivering incredible value to our customers with minimal inventory? Mm-hmm. And that's why we started focusing on a lot more things like our Kogan First program, where we've got almost 460,000 members. In that program, we've launched an advertising platform for our marketplace.
Yeah, is it true that it's Kogan First? You've got more coming in gross profit and sales from the subscription-based business.
Yeah. That's so if incredible. You add up all of our now non-inventory-based sales, so if you add up the marketplace sales, Kogan First, our advertising platform, our verticals, it's like 70 or 80% of our GP. We've really optimized it from that perspective. And that's, I guess, through the lessons learned post-COVID and having too much inventory. It's been quite a journey.
Yeah, it definitely has. With your story back at, you know, working at Accenture, what resonated with me was the fact that you're like, you know, when you first go for the interviews, you look at the brochures, you see these people working on their laptops in the park, and they're all smiling at each other. And I was like, and then you get in there, you're in these cubicles, you're not really smiling that much. I'm like, oh my God, this is exactly, I've seen those brochures. I'm feeling the exact same thing. What do you think working corporate has taught you about company culture and how that shapes your leadership style and company culture?
The main thing it's probably taught me is when you have lots of people like a Accenture or a KPMG or the corporates do, you're going to have some incredible talent there. Right now, sitting at Accenture and KPMG are some incredibly talented, really good people. If you force them to behave in the same way that everybody else behaves in the organization, you might squash that intellect or drive or innovation. And it's really important to cause a culture where you provide an environment where somebody brilliant can blossom. And I think that you can only do that through running a meritocracy, through running a business where the only way you progress is based on the quality of your work and your ideas.
Agree.
And no matter where you are in the organization, your opinion is valuable. Like, I'll have people from our call center come knock on my office and say, hey, I've been hearing a lot of that, or are we ever going to expand into this, or, you know, things like that. And look, a lot of the time it's something we've already thought about or debated, and, you know, I can explain why we're not going to do that or why that doesn't work. But every now and then there's a brilliant idea. And we've had people at our organization elevate from starting off in the call center to now being one of our senior leaders. And I think that that is really important. And that acceleration can happen very quickly. Like, if you are brilliant at ideas and brilliant at executing and have such a passion for the business and just are happy to put in the hard work and make stuff happen, you can accelerate super, super quick. In a lot of corporates, the acceleration is like, well, you start as a junior analyst, and after 2 years, you're just an analyst, and another 2 years after that, you're the senior analyst, then you're the
assistant manager. It's like, yeah, assistant manager level two.
It's not like, hey, you start here, but if you're really, really brilliant, you go boing, like that. And because of that, your depressing ideas and depressing innovation can cause a lot of brilliant people to, unless they break out of that cycle, to become dull.
Kogan has this thing where saying this is how we've always done it is a fireable offense. I really like that. So we've had people who come in with, like, you know, lots of experience, and they tell you this is how we should do it because this is how I've done it at these other retailers. It's not as simple as that, because otherwise everyone could just Google everyone else, just do exactly what other people are doing, and they don't derive the things from first principles and actually problem solve.
It's very important, I think. And as you mentioned, first principles are so important in e-commerce, because we don't have the advantage that other more mature industries have in hiring, in the sense that if I go and open a supermarket and I need a store manager, I can hire one from Coles or Woolies, and chances are they'll be a really good store manager. In our industry, it's so young that you don't know, there's no playbook, and there's nobody who's worked in that role for a decade or doing all these things. So we've had to hire just really clever people who can learn from first principles and work out what a certain role should be. And as a result of that, you know, we've had doctors running departments at Kogan because, hey, they knew nothing about that line of work prior, but if you're a doctor, you're pretty smart and know lots of other stuff. And you learn a few shortcuts along the way that I remember even in our hiring, when you advertise, you get thousands of applications, but we learned that people with a Gmail account or their own domain are usually quite tech savvy and love technology, and you learn these.
Oh my God.
It's probably not a fair one. Like, I'm sure there's some people with a Hotmail account who are
My husband judges people who have Hotmail accounts and they apply, and he tells them about it afterwards. Yeah. He said to, I won't name names, but he said to people afterwards, like, I really judge you on your Hotmail account.
Because it means they set it up so long ago and haven't bothered
evolved,
to change.
Yeah.
And the world has since evolved from a sort mentality to a search mentality. the whole original Hotmail, Microsoft Outlook thing was you file things in folders. Now it's like, oh, whatever. It's just there and just you put in a keyword and you find the email you're looking for. And that, like, I remember loving that so much that I paid for my first invite to a Gmail account, like however many years ago, probably close to 20 years ago now. But you can do these sort of shortcuts. Like also, if I'm in an interview, I find out that somebody runs marathons. It's like, it's almost interview over, hire them.
Yeah, because they've got that determination, they work hard, that
So in the same way that you'd hire someone who says they run marathons, you really shouldn't work with someone who says we are doing this because that's just how we've
done it. Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
No, I love that. So we're dangerously running low on time. I wanted to find out about what home life is like for you.
It's pretty good. I've got two kids there.
Yeah, what age?
2.5 and 5 months.
Oh, amazing. And you're like 6 months behind me.
Okay.
Like the same age gaps. Yeah.
And they're just absolutely, they're my world. They're delightful.
That's
and
amazing.
Yeah, so love, and I thought I loved home life prior to that, but they just elevated it to the next level and they give you a much higher purpose in everything that you do.
I will warn you, the next 6 months are, in my opinion, the hardest, because the 6-month-old starts moving around so much more and then you've got two to run after. I think that it's a nice little calming moment when the small one's less mobile. But
I can't wait till they can like
play together.
Oh. Yeah. But yes. I don't know what age that happens. Obviously, yeah, not within the next 6 months.
No, by
the
sound not yet. How do you balance, like, you know, running a listed company that has so many departments and life and, like, what do you
Yeah, I guess do? It's impossible unless you love what you do. I know a few friends and people I know who are in corporate jobs or maybe jobs they don't love, and it's like, oh, I've got work tomorrow. Oh, I've got this. I'm like, I check my calendar the prior day. I'm like, oh my God, can it be 11 a.m. tomorrow already? Because I've got this meeting and I can't wait to discuss this and I want to know the answer. And I get to work with such an amazing team and it makes me jump out of bed in the morning. So I don't think that the public company part of it changes anything much. I work just as much before and after and all of that. But I guess the biggest thing is that you've got to really love what you do. It's like that saying that's so true, the love what you do, you won't work a day in your life.
Yes, that's one of my life.
You've got to strive for that, because it's also one thing you realize is that which is not sustainable cannot be sustained. So if you don't love what you do, you're not going to be that good at it. You're not going to be that motivated. Eventually, you'll do a pretty bad job at it. It'll make you upset. You'll end up quitting. You'll end up like, it's a vicious cycle. So it's really, really important that you find a pursuit, because it's taking, like, look at our lives. Like, as an entrepreneur, probably working 10, 12 hours a day, you have to sleep for 8 hours a day. There's 24 hours in a day. You should have a shower and stuff and grab a bit of food here and there. It's like, so if you look at the portion you spend at work, it's over 50% of our conscious life. Like, make sure it counts.
Yeah, absolutely. Otherwise, it's not sustainable. What do you do then to switch off and, like, treat yourself or, like, just unwind?
Yeah, I would have at least one sauna session a day, sometimes even two.
I feel like such a Melbourne thing. I feel like so many Melbourne guests maybe have like saunas that I've bought.
Yeah. So maybe because we don't get the warm weather you guys do here, we have to artificially create it. But yeah, jumping, going like sauna, dip pool. And maybe also because in the sauna, it's too hot for the phones to work.
Yeah,
so
then you
I'm
have
like,
to.
It really is. It's almost like a form of meditation. Yeah. So I love doing that. Love going for a run, because then leave the phone at home, just me and my Garmin, and thoughts going through your head. So they're sort of the switch off things. Used to be fishing, but don't have the time for at the moment.
And then you can go on your phone, so you're just like, you go back to work.
Now, fishing would actually be one of those times that, or at least if the fish are biting, I'm fully focused on focused on that, yeah.
Do you have your two truth and one lie prepared?
Yeah.
Okay.
I do most of the cooking in the house. I do most of the tidying and cleaning in the house. And I often wash my own clothes in hotel rooms.
Okay. I think the lie is the B, the cleaning in the house.
Okay.
Am I right?
You got it.
Okay. Do you know why? Okay, because the similar traits to you are my husband. He is the one that cooks. The one that's most easily able to outsource is getting someone to clean for your house. And then I also sometimes clean my, we'll do my own laundry because it's like also, it's so expensive, but also like the delay, the management, I'm like, I can't even deal with it. If you wash it, it's done.
I'm just like, I look in hotel rooms and it's for the laundry. It's like $29 to wash a t-shirt.
I'm like,
but my t-shirt's 10 bucks. Yeah. I just can't bring myself around to pay 29 bucks to wash a $10 t-shirt. It's not how I was raised.
They charge the same for kids' clothes. This costs less from Kmart than to actually wash it.
Yeah. So it's like when I see that, there's sometimes I do it for certain other things or for convenience. But it's like I'm never going to spend $29 at a hotel to wash a $10 t-shirt.
Exactly. Yes. I love it when I get it right. Okay.
And you were quick as well and definitive. I should have done better.
No.
I want to play the applause.
Yeah. I'm normally very indecisive. I think I was just in my head like, Jay, just
you're
go
like,
with your
woman. I was like, shit, she got it. And straight away, definitive, got
but I'm
it.
Like, okay, that's what I would do. Thank you so much. This has been such an amazing chat.
Thank you.
Could you leave us with your advice for other entrepreneurs and buddy entrepreneurs that might be listening? That are listening. Yeah. They are listening.
I think that the best advice for entrepreneurs has been printed on Nike t-shirts for years.
Oh.
Because
love this.
There is so many times I'd speak at a conference or meet someone with an idea and the idea sounds good and they seem energetic. And then I'd see them a few years later and I'm like, how's business going? And they're like, what business? People just don't take that next step for action. I think an entrepreneur is an inventor and an athlete in one, which is where the Nike bit comes into it. And the best advice they've been printing on their t-shirts for years being just do it. Take that next step, give it a crack, especially if you're young, you've got so little to lose. Have a go, implement your idea. People sometimes search for perfection before they start and it doesn't work. Like if you, even us discussing the Kogan business today, it's been through 50 pivots over the last 18 years. Yeah. Your business has been the same.
So many iterations.
You see what customers want, you iterate, you pivot, you change and so on. So I think that with an entrepreneurial journey, it's important to just start, do it, have a crack, and iterate from there.
Have a bias for action. Love it. Just fucking do it, everyone.
That's it.
Thank you.
Lovely to chat, Jane. Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
Okay, that's it from me for now. Thanks for listening. And if you're loving the podcast, don't forget to leave us a review. And if you want more, join the conversation on the podcast Instagram at thelazyceo_podcast. Link to the show notes. Catch you next Tuesday.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.